my metro stop when I was living in Cairo was the Aqaba stop. But it wasn't only my metro stop. It wasn't only part of my routine. It was a place of symbolic importance to me. Above the metro stop was this epic book market, where when I was tired of working in archives and libraries, I would stop by to look for material for my dissertation. Magazines, old newspapers, books. I even once grabbed an old food magazine for the sake of it. And as important as the material I was actually looking at was, in terms of the idea they articulated, I was curious how the material got there and where it would end up. What lives these ideas would continue to have. That's the theme of today's interview. My name is Ene Mansour, or Nadira, and welcome to New Books Middle East Studies, part of the New Books Network. Alexander Bevilacqua is an assistant professor of history at Williams College. He specializes in the cultural and intellectual history of early modern Europe, 1450 to 1800. He has a bachelor's from Harvard College, a master's from the University of Cambridge, and a doctorate from Princeton University. From 2014 until 2017, he was a junior fellow in the Harvard Society of Fellows. His work has appeared in History of European Ideas and Past and Present. He has edited, along with F. Clark, Thinking in the Past Tense, forthcoming in January 2019 with University of Chicago Press, and he's the author of a book, The Republic of Arabic Letters, Islam and the European Enlightenment, out 2018 from Harvard University Press, and winner of the Thomas J. Wilson Memorial Prize of Harvard University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. So we always sort of start off with a bit of a biographical question. What's your own intellectual history? I know we're talking about intellectual history today, but sort of how did you come to what you studied? What is the story of this book and how did it come about?
Well, something that has always interested me is the way people make sense of each other across boundaries of religion, of language, of culture, of nation, and how they've made sense both of humankind's similarities as well as differences. And of course, there are many ways of treating this problem. And when I was younger, I was interested in the history of political thought. And so in particular, in cosmopolitan political theory. And at some point, I realized, though, that these political thinkers I was reading, and these were Western thinkers, didn't have a very rich sense of these peoples of the world that they were writing about. And I thought it would be much more interesting to look at the people who had actually dedicated their lives to being involved with somebody else's cultural, intellectual, religious traditions. And I had been studying Arabic sort of on the side to my own main preoccupations with European history. And eventually, I realized that I should be working on the early history of Arabic scholarship in the West in order to understand, first of all, why people had been interested in the early modern period, in the 17th century and onwards, in Arabic language culture, and what concepts had organized and mediated that set of intellectual encounters.
What specifically actually brought you to Arabic? I'm really curious because it's such a bizarre language in many ways. It's a classical language. It's a living language. What attracted you to it?
Well, it's not a very fancy answer. It was, I think learning a language is such a huge investment that in the end, personal reasons and effective reasons as well are really important. And in my case, I thought it was a beautiful language. I was very in awe of the enormous literary tradition that it represented. And as a person who grew up on the northern shore of the Mediterranean in Italy, it seemed an important language to learn. So in a way, I just felt I need to start learning more about a culture that is sort of so proximate to Southern Europe and yet in a way so... So comparatively little cultivated by Europeans, or at least speaking for myself, I was in a place of ignorance and I thought I should learn more.
And it's such a deep well to dive into, so bravo there, because Arabic is not an easy task. So this book starts off with a history of books. And I do want to say one of the things I loved about this book is its organization. It just reads so easily. You set it up so easily for the reader to sort of follow along. And that's why I think that you start off with the history of books, is that the history of books is very fundamental to intellectual history. And I was wondering if you could articulate a bit more what the relationship of the history of the book is to intellectual history.
Absolutely. Well, I think that intellectual history has been enormously enriched by the development of the history of the book as a discipline in the last several decades. And I think if we're interested in the history of ideas, we would be really remiss if we weren't also to ask how those ideas were expressed and divulged and transmitted and taken up. And all of these questions can be, I think, fruitfully answered by looking at the material aspects of intellectual production. So in the case of the Republic of Arabic Letters, in the case of this interest and engagement with Islamic culture in 17th and 18th century Europe, it was really important to me to show that it was grounded in the circulation of objects. These translations that I studied wouldn't have been possible without the acquisition of primarily Arabic, but also Persian and Turkish manuscripts in various places in North Africa and the Levant and even further afield. And so I thought the story really has to start with this, because otherwise it just seems like a disembodied history of people changing their minds, you know, sort of. It's much more abstract. It comes to seem more abstract than it really was. And in particular, the circulation of books is just one part of an intensification of all kinds of mobility, of people in particular, but also of things in the early modern period. Something we might describe as early globalization. And I think it's really important to consider this intellectual history as a response to this early globalization.
So since we're talking about the material aspect, and I do feel like we're in the midst of a material turn in intellectual history, I have talked to you over the course of the last couple of months, specialists in the development of Arabic script, in the development of the Arabic book, and it seems like we're really living in sort of a renaissance of sorts of Arabic book history, and I'm glad that this is a part of it, so congratulations on that. But I was wondering if you could describe for us what a manuscript physically looks like and how it also compares to printed books, because what's interesting about this is that there are two different currents running through this book, which is the Arabic tradition, which these European scholars are pulling on. But there's also, this is the age of print in Europe. So manuscripts on one side and printed books on the other side.
Absolutely. That's a fabulous way of thinking about things, because our current usage, I think, misleads us a little bit. We tend to distinguish manuscripts from books as if book were synonymous with printed book. But of course, that's not the case. And manuscripts are books too. And what's interesting about Arabic manuscripts for a European reader in this period, sort of from between, let's say, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, is that it is a very familiar object in a way. So I wouldn't overemphasize, I don't think the fact that that it's not printed, that it's written by hand, is in any way an obstacle to comprehension for Europeans, because first of all, they are familiar with manuscripts of, for instance, works in classical Greek that have been collected and edited and published in recent memory. And second of all, Arabic is an alphabetic language. It's even some aspects of page design are not dissimilar from things in the Western tradition of book production. So although the kinds of paper materials used may be slightly different, ultimately this was a deeply familiar object. And this convergence is what made, I think, the Islamic intellectual tradition not only legible to European readers, and I mean that metaphorically, that is not only comprehensible, but also It seemed like a kindred one. So it seemed like a very familiar tradition. So it seemed that there was an analogy between the people who were producing these books, say in Istanbul, and the kinds of people who were working with books, including manuscript books, in Western Europe.
So, as I mentioned, the book starts off with this history of books to some extent, but it's actually the history of how books, how Arabic language books, and as you mentioned, other languages, and as this book emphasizes, these Arabic, Turkish, Persian are not widely studied in Europe during this period. So how do they get to European libraries or to European owners, more specifically, and then to the scholars?
So Arabic books are prestigious objects. So we should consider their collection something that certainly is done for scholarly reasons, but that may also have less noble or less abstract motivations. That is, it's exciting to show off in your elegant library, if you're a wealthy patron of learning, that you have books in foreign scripts, including ones in this famous language, which is at this time considered to be extremely ancient, you know, almost as ancient as Hebrew. So there's an enormous cachet that attaches to Arabic books. So if we're looking at motivations, it's not just scholars, but also collectors who will never read Arabic who are interested in having these books. In terms of practical nuts and bolts, these books are acquired mostly in book markets in different cities. So for instance, in Aleppo and in Istanbul, in Cairo, in various North African cities as well. And if you look at Persian books, the geography takes you all the way to South Asia, of course. So what is happening is that there are merchant networks at this time, networks of European merchants operating in different Asian cities. And scholars sometimes accompany these people or visit them and use these networks as an opportunity for book collecting.
So one thing that I also, that runs through the book, I don't think they're the principal players or the actors or even the principal settings, but there is heavy reference to modern research libraries, such as those at, for example, the Oxford University's library and the manuscripts and books that end up there. So how do these books and manuscripts tie into the rise of the modern research library? Because today, a lot of these libraries are where scholars like yourself and myself go to access these materials.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that because we have a sort of a common conception that the sort of so-called Oriental collections of these great European libraries, like, say, the Bodleian in Oxford or the Leiden University Library in the Netherlands, that those collections were begun in the 19th century, in the period of European colonialism. And certainly they were enriched in that period. But what's interesting is that the nucleus of the Oriental manuscripts in Oxford or in Leiden or in other places like the Vatican Library in Rome and the formerly Royal, now National Library in Paris, these collections were built in the early modern period. They are still, some of the manuscripts that were acquired at this time by the gentleman whom I've discussed in my book are still important references for researchers today. We're still learning from these collections. And it does tie in, as you suggested, with the rise of the modern research library. These collections are put together to expand knowledge, and underlying many of them is a dynamic idea of what a library is. So there are multiple ideals of the library at this time and in Europe. And one is a static notion that you can sort of encompass all knowledge if you are wealthy enough and organized enough. But there is also an idea that knowledge can ever be increased, and that especially once you get interested in non-European traditions, that you can always be acquiring more books. And people's travels seem to confirm this. People go to the New World and report about the different kinds of books that are produced there or in South Asia as well. And what's interesting is Europeans are able to see, to identify as books, even things that are much more foreign to them than an Arabic manuscript book. For instance, collections of palm leaves, you know, with script on them from South India, or even describe the system of quipus of tying knots used by the Inca as a form of writing. So they take a really broad concept of their remit, and so we can really describe these library collections as research collections.
So the people that use these research collections, the first to use these research collections, the people who studied these books, you refer to them as the Arabic Republic of Letters. And I was wondering if you could give us a quick rundown of who they were, but also what motivated them to study Islam. In what sense, what is their intellectual biography?
Absolutely. So by a Republic of Arabic Letters, I mean a community strewn across Europe of Christians, scholars who were studying Arabic. And these people did not necessarily know each other personally, and they were of different confessions. So some were Catholic, some were Protestant. And yet they were engaged in largely the same project, which was the study, the cultivation of the Arabic literary and intellectual tradition. So we can think of it as a sort of a network of people who are certainly competing as well as collaborating, but nevertheless, who have fundamentally a shared understanding of the task at hand. And the task at hand is understanding this vast tradition to which Europeans feel that they have come so late. And what's interesting about this fixation, I would say, on Arabic in the 17th century and after into the 18th, is that there are so many different motivations, and we can't really reduce them to a single one. As I mentioned earlier, people recognize that Arabic is connected to Hebrew, so it sort of basks in the reflected glory of Hebrew, and people indeed study Arabic perhaps to improve their knowledge of biblical Hebrew in hopes that they will be able to understand some obscure passages in the Hebrew Bible. But there are many other motivations as well. Some are polemical. They're ones that we wouldn't expect to help improve knowledge of Islam. People want to disprove the claims of the Quran, but they realize that in order to do that, they need really good Arabic, and they need to not only read the Quran well, but also to understand the tafsir tradition, the tradition of Muslim interpretation of the Quran. So there's really a variety of motivations. The one that seems it perhaps most unexpected to us today is the notion that the tradition of Renaissance humanism, the rediscovery of the classics of Greece and of Rome and their re-edition and translation, that this movement needs to sort of go global, that it needs to be expanded to encompass all kinds of other written traditions. And this is something that people explicitly articulate by the end of the 17th century. And that is one of the several reasons that people have for caring about Arabic in Western Christian Europe at this time.
So as we mentioned, and in this term is present throughout the book, it's present in the title, the Republic of Letters, the Arabic Republic of Letters. What motivated you to use this specific term, which is quite common and it's commonly accepted aspect of how we study the Enlightenment? What motivated you to apply this to a specific, to this specific set of scholars? Because it does sort of fit that bill. It is this community of individuals who aren't directly, they don't directly know each other, but it's a long distance intellectual conversation that's happening over the course of many of generations. So is this part of the Republic of Letters as we know it? Is it a parallel? How would you sort of cast it?
Absolutely. I think that the concept of a European Republic of Letters, which has been taken extremely seriously by scholars in the last two decades or so to describe the international community of European scholars from about the time of Erasmus of Rotterdam into the 18th century, I think that is a very powerful concept and a wonderful insight into how scholarly community and scholarly ethics and intellectual goals worked in a time of fragmentation, in a time of wars of religion and of competition between states. And it acknowledges the ethos that bound these scholars together, as well as their intellectual projects. So the Republic of Arabic Letters is sort of a subset of this broader community, or we could say a province of the European Republic of Letters. It is constituted of the people who had learned Arabic and who became seriously involved in researching Arabic-related topics. And so many of the same kind of rules of engagement apply to these people as to the broader European community as a whole. And I would say just in terms of why did I decide to use this term, when I started this research project a number of years ago, I began with some of the major projects from both Catholic and Protestant Europe that had made it into print. For example, George Sale's translation of the Quran into English, which was the first translation directly from Arabic into English and appeared in London in 1734. And I worked my way through manuscripts, through my manuscript research, to the realization that all of these people were part of the same intellectual world. They were all communicating with each other, whether directly or more often just through their printed output. And so I realized that my interest in these discrete projects wasn't just a sort of an anachronism of my perspective of looking back several hundred years later. It actually did justice to the fact that all of these projects emerged from the same milieu. And so I wasn't crazy, in other words. There was actually a story here about scholarly community as well as scholarly competition, and it needed to be reconstructed.
No, I think the book does an excellent job of connecting it to the wider context. I think you never feel like you're just looking at this set of scholars who know Arabic and can address these texts. I think you definitely get a sense of they are part of this larger world. They're being affected by their contexts. They're being motivated by, as you mentioned, many different goals and many different approaches to Islam, which I found just, it was a very rich picture that you drew. So the book, as I mentioned, starts with book, the movement of books and book collecting, libraries, and then it goes on to, and I think very organically so, to your credit, the translation of the Quran. So what do these translations, and you mentioned George Sale's translation in 1734, what do they tell us about how these different scholars approach different branches of Islamic knowledge? Because Islamic knowledge is such a, whenever I try to explain it to someone who isn't immersed in Islamic studies, I feel like I need to, it's just this huge compendium of different forms, branches of knowledge. And you're very clear in articulating that the scholars you're writing about are engaged with them.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with the Quran. The Quran is of extreme interest to Europeans at this time, as I suppose it still is to Western people today, in part because they think they know what it is. They think that they understand it because it seems to be analogous to the Bible in many ways. So it's the most famous book in Arabic. And of course, this recommends it not just to editors and translators and serious people, but also to people who want to make money. So to printers. We don't have definitive evidence of this, but it's my impression that George Sales Quran is a commercial product. That is, that in part the idea came as much from his publisher as from the scholar himself, who hadn't evinced a great interest specifically in the Quran prior to undertaking this project. And this is another part of the story of the Quran in the West, which I think is important and interesting. It's the Quran is translated both into Latin, which is the language of scholarship, and in a way we could say the nearest equivalent to Arabic in that respect in the European context. But it is also translated starting in the Renaissance, starting in the middle of the 16th century, into vernaculars, that is, into languages like Italian, French, and English, which indicates that this is a book that is supposed to be of interest not just to scholars of religion, but to broader audiences. And some of its idea, for instance, its famous descriptions of paradise, although they are criticized by European theologians, they appeal to and reach a much broader audience. So people are attracted to lots of aspects of the Quran. So we can say, in a way, this is the Quran as literature. This is the Quran as a literary text that people who are not theologians are interested in reading as well. But in terms of, just to go back to your question, in terms of the many branches of Islamic knowledge, I think what we observe in this period is emphasis especially on convergences with the Western Christian tradition. So things like the Quran are eagerly translated, things like the study of Hadith, which is much sort of harder to wrap your head around for a European scholar at this time, just because of the lack of an exact equivalent. Those things get much less play. Which is not to say that these scholars aren't the first scholars in the West seriously to engage with Hadith, because they do. They just don't give it the prominence that the Quran gets. The Quran will always get more attention in the West. And when, if you look at a different area, let's say historiography, you find something similar. So for instance, universal histories that tell the whole story of mankind get a lot more attention than other kinds of genres of historical writing. And in part, I think that's because they promise the most bang for your buck. You translate one book and you get a whole a whole history of the world. But in part, it's also because universal history is a European genre as well. So we see here how convergent things are much more likely to be translated at this moment in time than things that are peculiarly or distinctively Islamic, that don't have an equivalent in the Western Christian tradition.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense to me, thinking back, because there is a history of commentaries in the Western tradition and the approach to the Bible, which always struck me because of my familiarity with Quranic exegesis, the fact that they were so similar. You mentioned a few moments ago, though, the relationship of colonialism, and that our perception of the formation of Oriental studies and Islamic studies in the West starts with colonialism, that our sense is, oh, there's this history of missionaries in the Middle East. There is this desire to know the other that one is colonizing. But as you mentioned, this begins pre-colonialism, because colonialism is a late 18th and 19th and 20th century phenomenon. So, but the way I think about it is that colonialism introduces a power dynamic. But this isn't quite what your subjects are under the influence of. I mean, I'm sure there are different notions of superiority wrapped in there somehow, but there isn't quite the same power dynamic, because they aren't colonizing Muslims in this way. So how were your subjects in conversation with Islam? How would you compare them to scholars of the Western tradition and writing about Islam in the 19th and the 20th century even.
Absolutely. I think that in general, in our sort of macro histories, we tend to sort of go from crusades to colonialism in terms of our memory of Western engagement with Muslim parts of the world. And that, of course, is a simplification. And what this book wants to show is that there was a window which certainly opened and then closed, but of about a century in which Christian scholars were quite excited about what they could learn from Islamic books. And I think it's important to rewrite that history into our historical memory. I think it changes even how we read the later period, the colonial period that we're more familiar with. But I really like your idea of comparing these early modern scholars with Islamic studies scholars today, because I see both similarities and differences. So on the one hand, to start with the differences, I guess, they are writing out of a sense of kinship and analogy. That is, they, just as they have their faith, these Muslim people they're writing about have their own. And they see many similarities, of course, rooted in a way, primarily in the genealogical connections between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So there's a sense in which this is a very big family with very strong disagreements, but nevertheless, it's a family. And so you can see similarities, and there are arguments about how Islamic systematic theology faces all of the same problems that Christian theology does. So people are constantly finding similarities, and in a way they are very different from modern Western Islamic studies scholars today, who are in some sense not engaged in the same task as the people whom they're studying. Although if you talk to anyone who relies heavily on medieval reference works, for example, they will feel a continuity in terms of the kind of tools of scholarship that are very old-fashioned in a way, or just just old rather than old-fashioned. Those are the tools of humanistic scholarship in many areas. But nevertheless, there's a sense, a clinical almost sense of distance, and we don't find that in this period. And even polemic. Polemic is something that nowadays we think alienates you from the thing that you're criticizing. But in this period, one of the effects of people's desire to write a polemic against Islam is that it makes them study it more closely. So they realize to refute this religion, you have to know it, and you have to do a better job than your medieval ancestors, because you have much better quality manuscripts available to you, much more knowledge. And so, in fact, what it does is it keeps you engaged with the commentarial tradition, with the tafsir tradition that you mentioned. It makes you study that tradition, because what you want ultimately is to understand the Quran in the way that Muslims do. So whereas in the 19th century, we find a whole tradition of Western scholarship, which is it's not taking the contemporary Muslim perspective on things. It's in fact giving alternative accounts to how Muslims interpret their tradition. And that starts in the later 18th century already. But in this period, so from the 17th century to the middle of the 18th century, the way to win an argument about what a verse in the Quran means is to say, this is how it's read in Istanbul. And once you say that, case closed. So these scholars are really, in a way, that they are closer to the Muslim horizon of interpretation than later Western scholars will be.
So we've been speaking a lot about the Islamic sciences, about the Quran, and you mentioned in passing universal histories. So I was curious, because these all sort of cover different spectrums of what it is to be Muslim or what it is to be Islamic, which is currently actually a big debate in the field of Islamic studies. But your subjects, your scholars, were they approaching Islamic thought and Muslim civilization differently? So sort of the rise of Muslim civilization in 7th century Arabia onwards. Were they writing and speaking about that in a way that was different to their approach to the Quran, for example, which you just mentioned?
Absolutely. I think that it's really important, first of all, just to flag that these people were interested in secular Muslim culture as well as in religious culture. So although I've used the word Islamic in a very broad sense in the book to cover both, we shouldn't think that they were merely obsessed with religion and that was the only thing that drew them to the study of Arabic. And the later chapters of the book focus on things like historical study and literature to a lesser extent as well, which was another area of great interest to European scholars. And I would say that there were several things about secular Islamic culture that interested these people. In terms of history, at the broadest level, they were just deeply impressed by the political achievements of early Muslim empire, by the tremendously rapid expansion of the Islamic State. And they thought, they compared this to the Roman Empire. The comparison is always with the achievements of the Romans. And the argument is, if we are interested in what the Romans achieved, we should all the more be interested in what the early Muslims achieved, because it's even more impressive. So for them, that was one of the great stories of world history, was the rise of Islam. And they wanted to do a better job of making sense of it. But then there was another question, which is perhaps what you were referring to in particular, which is the rise of all kinds of secular sciences in these early centuries, in the first six centuries of Islam. And they were interested in that as well, and they had different interpretations of how this came about and what it had to do with the Islamic revelation, whether it was intrinsically connected or not to the teachings of the Quran. And so people disagreed about this, but again, they thought it was important to make sense of this flourishing of arts and letters and sciences that had taken place. And they all, I mean, this was a very uncontroversial thing in early modern Europe, to acknowledge that the translation from Arabic into Latin in the Middle Ages had been a crucial moment in the history, in Western intellectual history, and that without those translations, European culture, as these people knew it, would have been substantially different. So that was something that no one ever really questioned or contested. The question that they did debate was, how exactly did all of these translations that had been done from Greek into Arabic, what were the motivations and what were the effects in Islamic history?
So you also mentioned that this window existed for a period before the other periods, which is the colonial approach to Islamic studies. So what was the legacy, so to speak, of this legacy? What was the legacy, so to speak, of this Arabic Republic of Letters?
Well, so what changes is the normative evaluation of Islam and of Islamic civilization, if we want to use that 18th century word, in Europe. And I think in the second half of the 18th century, what we see is that the earlier excitement, the earlier sense of discovery and enthusiasm for all things Arabic and all things Islamic, that wanes. So people stop thinking that the solution to all of their intellectual problems is going to be found in Arabic books. And this, of course, coincides with a moment of geopolitical weakness of Muslim states that is very different from the earlier moment of simultaneous flourishing of the Mughals, of the Safavids, and of the Ottomans. And while it's hard and a bit lazy, I think perhaps to try to connect intellectual change to geopolitics in any simple way, certainly that ambient change fuels a perception that somehow Islamic intellectual culture may be implicated in political decline, that somehow the religion and the intellectual culture it produced are connected to this geopolitical decline. And people in the later 18th century will make that argument explicitly. What doesn't change is that people continue to study Arabic. So we have to be able to separate normative evaluation from the process of knowledge production itself, which continues. And it continues in a way building on all of the achievements of the Republic of Arabic Letters. So, for example, when the great scholar Sylvestre de Sacy starts out, and if you look at the footnotes of his early works, it's a who's who of the Republic of Arabic Letters. So there's a very direct way in which scholarship continues using past results and, of course, improving on them. But I think there's a more interesting legacy as well, which is the idea that these books, which were written in such a sort of a hopeful mode, in with this sort of disposition of openness and of enthusiasm for a foreign tradition, those books don't disappear, and some continue to be republished. The biggest success story, of course, is George Sale's English translation of the Quran, which we mentioned earlier, which remains the standard English translation into the middle of the 20th century. So it has a 200-year history of being the way that Anglophone people who do not master Arabic encounter the Quran. And Simon Ockley's History of the Arab Conquests, which was written in the early 18th century, is republished more often in the second half of the 19th century than in the entire 18th century. So these works, which offer this particular vision of all the possibilities of Islamic culture, continue to exist even in that moment that we consider not just the high noon of European imperialism, but also of European ideology of superiority. And I think that should make us more critical in a way of that moment, because we see that there were other intellectual tools. There was a memory of another way of evaluating Islamic civilization that was less judgmental, and it wasn't completely forgotten. So I think it's a really important tool, even for scholars of the late 19th century, if they're interested in giving a historically sensitive critique of the normative positions and the knowledge production of the 19th century.
I really like that point, just because I think, like, as you said, it makes us a little bit more critical, because these things are part of our milieu. I do think as you mentioned, even though we don't use George Sale's translation of the Quran, I think most people who study Islam or in European intellectual history know that that was a very widely circulated, I mean, his name is a very iconic Quran to some extent. And I like that point. I think you're absolutely right. It does carry this air of criticism, and it does make us perhaps think more about our own work and how we approach things. And again, I think all intellectual history really forces you to think about your own context if you're writing history, and how your own environment and what other ideas you're bumping into influence what you write and how you read other sources. So to switch gears, because I'm always very, I think I'm a proper nerd, I'm always very curious about the research experience. What was it like to track down all these books, manuscripts, and papers? Because I can only imagine that you were just all over, going to many different libraries, using different techniques to read them. They're very different sources in some cases. So what was your methodology?
I just want to add one small thing on George Sale's Quran before I answer your question, which is that a famous scholar of Islamic studies of our own time, who was trained in an earlier era, whom you and I both know and whom I won't name in this interview, is has told me that the George Sale Quran translation is still useful if you want a quick reference from the footnotes to what the tafsir tradition has to say about something. So, and what I show in the book is that those footnotes were mostly taken from an earlier study by a Catholic scholar. They were done in 17th century Counter-Reformation Rome. So if you consider that Islamic scholarship today is still in some ways indebted to the work of a Catholic scholar in 17th century Rome, that makes you realize something about the kinds of legacies of humanistic scholarship that can be so enduring to the point where we almost can't imagine it. And yet it happens. In terms of my research experience, I'm not sure I have a lot, I have many teachable insights to offer about this, but I would say that casting a wide net was the key for me, and traveling to many different places, using the privilege that I was researching this book as an American graduate student. So with funding and time on my side, I decided to be ambitious, and I traveled all over Europe. And very few European scholars these days get to do a project quite like that, that is so connective. So that was really important to me. And another thing I learned is not to trust catalogs, especially not electronic catalogs, but also not to trust printed ones, to always ask, are there more items in your collection that are not included in the catalog? And the answer was often, funny you should ask. In fact, there are. And I learned that through trial and error, just to try to be comprehensive and to be patient. And eventually things come out of these collections and people remember things that they don't remember. If you just parachute in for a few days, it's impossible to extract things from their places in that way. And another thing I did was to look at marginalia, so in printed books. So wherever I went, I would look at all of the copies of the printed books that I was interested in, even if those had been produced elsewhere in Europe. And you know, every so often I would find some very exciting marginalia that would help me to understand how a book was read in its own time. So I think I don't think I even have a methodology other than just trying to be comprehensive, patient, and hopefully somewhat organized.
I know I mentioned this to you earlier, but that's actually someone who's doing a global project who everyone keeps telling is unwieldy, and everyone keeps asking me how I narrow down the sources. That's quite inspirational to hear. So I appreciate that. So we always sort of close the interview with a bit of a teaser question, sort of what are you working on now? What projects are you embarking on?
Absolutely. Well, I am starting to think about my next book, which is, it's perhaps a bit too soon to tease, but in the meantime, I am writing a short essay on a person who I think is of extreme interest and yet who has barely been studied until now. And this is a rather humble person, and perhaps that's why we haven't paid much attention to him. He was a interpreter, a dragoman, who worked in the French consular service. So a person of French identity who nevertheless spent most of his life living in the Mediterranean. And he ended, his life ended when he died during the siege of Acre, during the Napoleonic campaign in Egypt. So he became Napoleon's chief Arabic interpreter during the Egyptian campaign. So for me, he's a wonderful person for thinking about the connections between the Ancien Régime, between the world of knowledge production that I have spent many years reconstructing, and this new world that starts to form by the end of the 18th century, and the ways in which this very old knowledge got deployed for the imperial project of Bonaparte in Egypt. So it's a micro history, but I hope that it has something to say about, once again, the long history of knowledge production and the intersections of power with scholarship in a way that my book wasn't able to engage because of the periodization.
Can I ask a nitty-gritty, detail-y question?
Sure.
So I'm curious, just because classical Arabic is so different from spoken Arabic, and it's almost the same question I asked you about why you decided to learn Arabic. How did this dragoman learn Arabic, and do you know what he was speaking? Was he speaking a dialect? Was he...
I'm sure that he mastered multiple registers of Arabic because he had spent so much time living in not just in Egypt, but all over the Mediterranean, actually. But he was, although we translate dragoman as interpreter, they were, we should think of them really more as translators. So they were mainly people who sat at desks and translated correspondence and other kinds of documents. And to do this, he had been trained in classical Arabic, and his studies had been split between Istanbul and Paris, where by this point, by the 18th century, there was a school for training interpreters in Oriental languages. So he had had a double education, both in the Ottoman Empire and in Paris. And he was a specialist. He was, that was his entire professional training, was in these languages in order to be able to do these translations, which sometimes had very clear political implications. So he discovered, for instance, that a treaty that had been signed had been mistranslated, and that in the original Arabic text had a slightly different meaning, and that that changed things politically for the French. So this is the kind of work that he did. So he was closer to a philologist, closer to a person of the book than the word interpreter might make us think.
Okay, that sounds like a really exciting project. I'm going to keep my eyes open for it. Well, anyway, congratulations on the new book, and thank you for spending all this time with me today.
Thank you for your questions, and thank you for having me on the podcast.